Put it this way so it's less likely to fall off. When we'll get one second on that.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Yeshivat Hadar, to our kickoff evening for the summer. My name is Avital Hakstein, and I thought I would start maybe telling you a little bit about myself. My grandmother was born in Poland, probably just after the First World War, in a little town to a family who was a Hasidic family, part of a Hasidic sect called Bobov. And Bobov are known, among other, for beautiful music and beautiful tunes and beautiful singing. And around the Shabbat table, you know, she had seven brothers. They would all sing these tunes. Except she didn't join in because women weren't allowed to sing. You couldn't hear a woman's voice. So she was silent and she heard the tunes and got them into her body, into her soul. And then World War II happened and all her brothers were killed with their wives and children. She hid in Belgium, in a little village in Belgium, with my grandfather and my aunt. And after the war, they went back to Antwerp. My mom was born, and also later another aunt of mine. So my grandmother was there with three daughters, and around their Shabbat table. And while they were doing dishes in the kitchen, they would sing these Bobov tunes, those tunes that she wasn't allowed to sing when she was growing up. And most of us in my generation are also granddaughters, all singing these tunes. And I open with this story because I want to think with you today about stories and midrashim and relationships, in particular about moments of beginning. And for me, this story of my grandmother is my beginning. And this story is a midrash. It's a midrash on her life. It's a midrash on my life. And it serves as part of the framing for my life. Someone else might tell this story differently. Since it becomes now a text, its meaning is created somewhere in the space and in the meeting between me and all of you here listening to my story. This story is now going to define something about how you think of me and how you relate of me. It's of course also part of how I think of my grandmother and of myself. There's an interesting contradiction between the experience that we have of time, right? Because we can always ask of time what came before. And on the other hand, narrative always has a specific point in which it starts. In this sense, there's something maybe random or arbitrary about the point that I choose to start my story, the point that I choose as a beginning point. Though we know that a frame has a very big effect on how we actually experience a picture, right? The shape of the frame, the color, its size, all will very much affect how we experience the picture, what we see, what is emphasized. And this is, of course, also true about literary narratives, not only about pictures. The first Rashi in the Torah, I think, is actually very aware of this fact, because it starts with the question,
Amar Rabbi Yitzchak said, Lo haya tzarich lehatchil haTorah,
shouldn't he have started the Torah, he with a capital H,
Ela me'achodesh hazeh lachem,
from the verse in Shmot, this is your month, Shehi haMitzvah haRishonah, because that is the first mitzvah. Why did God decide to start the Torah from Genesis, from the creation of the world, and not from the first mitzvah. And the underlying assumption of this question is that there's a lot of meaning to the choice, in this case, that's made in the Torah, of what is going to be the point of beginning the question. So where one starts telling a story, and how one understands that moment of beginning, and of course how a tradition transmits its origin stories, all are cultural creations. And they shape and they form what we perceive as possible or impossible, as contingent or as permanent, universal or unique, who are central players and who are outliers. All those are affected by those opening moments. Now, this awareness, first of all, helps us understand what are some driving forces behind stories or behind storytellers. And they also give us the ability to imagine that there might be other forces that could drive these stories. And so this awareness has the possibility of turning fact into an option, into a possibility. The second thing I want to note about beginnings is that they hold the following tension. Every beginning questions, by its very nature, the beginning that came before it. But simultaneously, it also accepts it as a point of authority and a point of reference and a point on which it lies. I think children very often encompass this tension, right? The birth of a child is so tangibly a break from who you are. It's a beginning. It's frail. It's a manifestation of mortality in a very strong way. And yet, it's so strongly continuity, right? She looks just like you. And about my daughter, no one will say that, but people often say it about me and my father. And I always wonder if it's like this secret hope of immortality, maybe. So beginnings are both a rupture and a break from, and at the same moment, they're also very strongly in relation to. You see it in every Talmudic chapter, right? When you think of the letters Gimel, Mem, the letters that start the Talmudic discussion after the Mishnah, they symbolize now the Talmud is starting. We're starting a new generation of speakers and a different layer of thought. And on the other hand, that new generation of speakers and thought is totally connected to the Mishnah, derived from it, based on it. So that very opening really holds that tension. And what I want to do together this evening is I want to examine two stories of beginning. The beginning point that happens just after Moshe dies in the desert, just after Moses dies, and the other is a moment of beginning just after the destruction of the temple. And I want to examine them, and I want to ask about both stories three questions. The first question is, how does this tension between rupture and continuity play out in the stories? Is the emphasis in the rhetoric on the fact that it's a beginning or actually on the fact that it's continuity? Okay, for example, how does it play out? That's question number one. Question number two is there a place? Where do these stories take place? And what is the significance of this place? Okay, what do we make of this place? And the third question, well, has an assumption behind it. There's this expression, which is actually a Talmudic expression, kol ha'atchalot kashot, all beginnings are hard. And actually, there's something almost impossible about a beginning. Because on the one hand, a beginning is threatened by what came before it, right? Because maybe it's going to be continuity and not a beginning. And on the other hand, what enabled its very existence is an end, and it's threatened by its own possible end. Okay? So can we frame beginnings not as a broken or lacking outcome of some perfect past, okay, not as a product of destruction or banishment or death, but in a different way, in a way that is more about a new order? And what does that reframing mean? What kind of story will that be? I'm going to give out the sources. Take them, pass them around. And I want us to begin with the Tanaitic source, a source from the period of the Mishnah, so edited around the year 200, the Tosefta in Eduyot. Eduyot is a very interesting tractate and a little out of the ordinary. I just gave out the sheet.
Does anyone need the sheet that does not have one?
Give it another minute and we'll know how many we're missing. So Eduyot is a very unique tractate because it's not organized according to, should I wait one more minute for the technicalities? It's not organized with content as the guiding force, but rather it's a collection of testimonies, as its name also indicates. Eduyot actually means testimony. And so what guides its organizing theme is not a specific content, but just a collection of testimonies, which is why many of the Mishnayot and Halachot that we find in Eduyot, we actually find in other places where they should be content-wise. Okay, and they're found again in Tractate Eduyot. Who would like to read for us this description? Hebrew or English? English might be more of a common denominator. Maybe someone is willing to read. Great, Alexa, thank you. In the English, slowly, okay?
After having gathered in the vineyard of Yahweh, the keeper said, the time will not come when a person searches. The time will come when a person searches for a matter from the words of Torah and will not find it, from the words of scribes and will not find it. For it is written, behold, days are coming, says the Lord, when I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread nor a thirst for water, but for hearing the words of the Lord. As they shall wander from sea to sea, and from the north even to the east, they shall run to and fro to seek the word of the Lord, and shall not find it. The word of the Lord, that not a single word of Torah resembles the next. They said, let us begin from Hillel and Shammai.
Thank you. I find this text heartbreaking, this description, and it's actually the verse from Amos, which I think is so powerful, this heartbreaking description of searching not for water and not for bread, but for the words of Torah and not finding it. What a deep famine. Okay, and that is the motivation, okay, for this discussion. Okay, now it's also a very, very moving moment in history, right? The camera has moved to Yavne from Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been destroyed. And in the background, we have Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who went to the Roman emperor and said, please give me Yavne and its sages. Ten li et Yavne v'chachamea. And the Roman emperor accepted as he went and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. Okay, so seemingly we're at the moment of a very, very new beginning, right? Because the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem is the downfall of the city, demands something new. But through the request, we already hear that there's a background of some continuity, because there are sages in Yavne that are worth that are saved here. So the beginning isn't completely new and isn't only on destruction. Now, the cause of the gathering here might have been the destruction, but the impetus of this conversation is a fear of forgetting. It's a fear of the future, right? It's not the event in the past of destruction, but it's actually a fear of the future of forgetting of Torah. Yehe adam mechapes davar midivrei Torah velo motze. A person will look around for the words of Torah and not find it. So it's a historical moment that is motivated to start anew, but for fear of a lost past that's going to happen in the future, right? The rabbis now are afraid that in the future, the past will be forgotten, okay? And this future situation was prophesied by Amos, right, in the distant past, okay? So there's a very, a lot of swinging back and forth going on here. So it's a choice to start afresh in order to promise continuity. which also holds a contradiction, right? They decide the strongest, one of the strongest words in these texts is the word natril. Okay? In order to make sure that there's continuity, we better create a new beginning. Okay? It's a very interesting intuition, right? Starting over in order to continue. Now, the understanding of mechapes davar midivrei Torah ve'eino motze, searching for something of the word of Torah and not finding. It's not that nothing is found, right? But rather that what is found is shelo yeh davar midivrei Torah domeh lechavero. What is found, the pieces don't match up. One piece doesn't resemble the next. Something is found, but it's chaotic, it's scattered, it's incoherent, maybe you can't comprehend it. And in order to deal with the chaos, the suggestion is made, natchil, let's start. And not only a beginning, but an ordered, maybe random and maybe not, beginning, right? Natchil mi'ilel v'shamay, a very conscious point from which we are going to start. So I think that Tosefta here is demonstrating a very basic human attribute. People want points of beginning, and the want for beginning is actually a search for unity and for order, and the two go hand in hand. So the Tosefta kind of announces, I'm going to construct order, I'm going to create a beginning, I will overcome the potential of chaos and confusion by announcing Hillel and Shammai are the beginning. That's the act that I'm going to do. So this opening actually gives frame and context to explain the entire project of Masechet Eduyot, this tractate that deals with testimony. But that's not all. Not only will the words of Torah not be found without this project, but they will not be one, right? They will not be unified. Now, what is the project of Eduyot about if actually what we're starting with is Hillel and Shammai, right? There's already a contradiction here. Wait a minute, we're starting with two, looking for unity, looking for one Torah, and we're starting with two voices that we all know well are voices that contradict each other. In that case, the unity must be a unity of knowledge. We all agree Hillel and Shammai argued and disputed, and so the project of one Torah must be about preservation and organization. Order of the multiplicity, right? Not a unity of mind in the sense of consensus, but a unity of how we organize the information of Torah. Now let's go back to our three questions, and I'll remind you what they were. The first one was how the tension between rupture and continuity plays out in these texts. The second one was, is there a place where this happens, and what's the significance of this place? And the third one, is there a narrative other than there was a destruction and now we exist in a reality of lack that can explain this beginning? So let's start with the first one, how the tension between rupture and continuity plays out here. The sages don't start by saying, let's start from us, right? They say, let's start from the past, from Hillel and Shammai. So this is a beginning story that describes the beginning somewhere else, right? Just like I started my story not with I was born in New York, but my grandmother was born in Poland. In order to create some unity between myself and my past, which I'm cutting myself out of, I immediately create myself a beginning that is all the way back there, okay? And then this new beginning is very connected to where it came from before. Is there a place here? So this historic gathering didn't take place on the destructed temple, right? It didn't happen in Jerusalem amidst the ashes. It happens in Yavne. How many of you have been to Yavne? Okay, Yavne is not a very well-known place, okay? It's not a central place. So the beginning here denies the centrality of place, okay? Like I started with a small shtetl somewhere in Poland. Okay, there's something about the cultural choice here of beginning not to choose a central place. And we'll try and think soon why. Now, what about the possibility of a narrative that isn't about breaking and a continuity that is a product of that brokenness? The description of the new reality here is, Natchil mi'Hillel v'Shammai. It's not a description of lack, but it's a description of new order, right? With a new focal point, a new almost origin, right? Possibly Hillel and Shammai and maybe even the notion of dispute all become like the organizing character of Masechet Edoyot and of the beginning point here. This move into the past has a cunning element to it because it blurs both the fact and the significance of the destruction, right? It suggests to slowly move through the destruction. We start with Hillel and Shammai, who lived still when the temple was in existence, and will slowly stream through all our other testimonies, almost ignoring the destruction of the temple completely. Okay, so we recognize this blurring also from other places. Tractate Avot. How does Tractate Avot start? Moshe kibel Torah mi Sinai, right? Moses got the Torah from Sinai. Go on. Umsarah Yoshua gave it to Joshua, Yoshua to the elders, and the elders to Knesset HaGdolah. Exactly. Completely turning into one the existence of Torah in the desert and what the sages do later on. Okay? There's no desert, there's no going into the land of Israel, there's no kingship, there's no first temple, there's no second. Okay? Completely erasing almost history, but in order to blur points of beginning, end, and that's how we begin anew. Okay, we begin anew by blurring points, by choosing a point in the path that will slowly blur the changes that took place. Okay, I want to leave aside Eduyot unless somebody wants to share a thought or a comment, and move on to Moshe, to the death of Moshe in the desert. Okay, so let's read the story of Moshe. What we have here is three different versions of the story of Moshe's death and what happened right after the days of mourning for Moshe. Maybe I'll ask somebody to read, and after we read, maybe you'll share some thoughts about how you hear the differences between the different versions. Okay? Someone willing to read for us? Great, thank you.
Rabbi Huda said in the name of Shmuel, 3,000 laws were forgotten during the mourning period for Moshe. They said to Joshua, ask. He quoted to them the verse, it is not in heaven. They said to Samuel, ask. He said to them, these are the laws. A prophet may not do anything from now on. Said Rabbi Huda in the name of Rab, when Moshe died and went to heaven, he said to Yehoshua, ask me any doubt you may have. Yeshua said to him, my rabbi, have I left you even for one moment and went elsewhere? Did you not write about me? And his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a youth, did not budge from the tent. Immediately, Yeshua's energy was drained out of him. He forgot 300 laws, and 700 doubts were born to him, and all of Israel stood up to kill him. God said to him, I cannot tell you, but go and occupy them with war. In the Mishnah they taught.
Terrible, huh?
In the Mishnah they taught, 1,700 laws and learnings were forgotten in a time of mourning for Moshe. Said Rav Abahu, but Otniel, the son of Kenaz, brought them back out of his learning.
Okay, great. So you see three different versions, right, of what happens right after Moshe's death, right when they come, when they come up from the days of mourning. So what do they have in common? How are they different from each other? Take a minute to look at them. There's one strong fact that they all have in common. I think maybe only one.
Between grief and
forgetting. Great. The association between grief and forgetting, and you're already giving some meaning to it, right? That these halachot are forgotten. Right? These halachot are forgotten in all three versions. Great. What are some differences between them? Or what stands out?
The number of laws forgotten.
The number. Is it a big number or a small number? How do you hear it?
Well, certainly 3,000, well, I think it's 613, that means we lost more than we kept. That's
right.
A big number.
Okay, it feels like a very big number, right? It's one of these, a 3 is a generic number, and 3,000 is like a huge number, right?
So if there was a there was a Shloshim period associated with the mourning for Moshe, then the 30
100 a day.
Times 10, that means they lost...
100 a day, right?
A day, yeah.
Okay, it's a huge number. Yeah, good. Okay, yes.
Different in each of them is the response to forgetting, what happens when we forget our learning. But in the first one, there's the immediate urge to ask and have something be answered. In the second one, like in the midst of forgetting, being occupied with the rule. In the third one, the knowledge just somehow comes back. Like someone, one person brings it back.
Has the ability to do it.
Entire people like, sort of demanding and sort of trying to go with it.
Yep, great. Good. So let's slowly. Let's read through them slowly, okay? Start with the first. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda, in the name of Shmuel, told us the following story. 3,000 halachot, laws, were forgotten in the days of the mourning of Moshe. We'll get back both of the comments you made into the question of why this forgetting happens. I want to just suggest what exactly is forgetting, what's forgotten here. Because of the number, it feels like there's something quantitative that is now missing, right? The time after Moshe is now lacking in quantity of knowledge. I just wonder if there's also something of quality. Even though the conversation here is with numbers, I wonder if there's a whole thing, and now part of it is missing, is it also an issue of quality that is going to look different in the life after? And now there's this strong demand, right? Amrula li Yoshua sh'al. They say to Yoshua, go and ask. Okay? It's interesting. The demand is not go learn. The demand is go and ask. Right? This is what the children of Israel in the desert are accustomed to. They're accustomed to being given the knowledge. Right? They are dependent. And they assume that their leaders are dependent as well. Right? They don't assume that Yoshua can go and learn. They think that in order to get information, he needs to ask it. The only glimpse of hope here from Bnei Israel is that they ask the question. Okay, right? That they make the demand on their leader, go and get us that information. Right? But there's no feeling that they can be independent. And then the response, which I imagine you've seen in other Talmudic texts, right? Lo bashamayim hi, right? Yoshua says it's not in heaven. The place of Torah, the place of knowledge, is now, at this new beginning, in a different place. We have to figure out knowledge by ourselves, right? Now, there's four implications to this statement. First of all, knowledge doesn't exist anymore, post-Moshe, without human intervention. Okay, I assume if you've seen this verse, it was in that context. Number two, knowledge is accessible to everyone, right? Equally, at this point. It's here, it's down here, everyone, right? Yoshua doesn't say, I'll go get it. Right? He says, it's now for everyone. Okay. The third implication is that we have here a beginning point that is a point of break, is a point of disconnection, because it's no longer a direct connection with God. Okay? But I wonder if there's a reinstating of Torah here in the following way. If Moshe, when he wanted some bit of information, if this imagines him going directly to God, it means the place of Torah was very minimal in the existence in the desert post having been given the Torah. Right? And to a certain degree, Moshe's death and the direct line going is a kind of reinstating of Torah being the source of knowledge. Okay, which maybe it wasn't so in the desert itself. And in that sense, again, there's a tension here between rupture and continuity. Okay? Interestingly, the same conversation takes place a few generations later, this time with Shmuel. They say to Shmuel, go and ask. And he says to them a different verse, these are the mitzvot. And now he gives an interpretation that's interesting. She'en hanavi rashai lechadesh davar me'ata. The prophet is not allowed to innovate anymore from this point. The word navi, prophet, here might be very important. A prophet is not allowed to innovate because his tools of innovation are passé. They're not legitimate anymore. But the sages, they have room to innovate. Okay, maybe that's standing behind the words of Shmuel. Many sources that I imagine some of you have seen before use these verses as the basis for the legitimacy of the rabbis to innovate, to be autonomous vis-a-vis Torah, and so on. But there is here also an element of putting responsibility on the community, right? Both Yehoshua and Shmuel don't say to the people, it's up to us. They say it's up to you. Okay? There's a rejection and a refusal on their part to just simply give the answer. So with the death of Moshe, the source of Torah and of knowledge changes. It's no longer heaven or prophecy. Right now the law is perceived as something very tangible, very present, very reachable. And there's responsibility for acquiring knowledge, not only on the leadership, but also on the people. So that's version number one. Now let's turn to story number two. remind me what happens with story number two. Who remembers the details of what happens? A conversation between Moshe and Yehoshua. Right? I like titling this story, because I have a father who's a scientist, What's the Evolutionary Value of Forgetting? Okay? In science, you don't say something is good or bad, but you ask what its evolutionary value is, because if it doesn't have evolutionary value, it wouldn't have lasted. Okay? So what's the evolutionary value of forgetting? Said Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, when Moshe died and went to heaven, he said to Yehoshua, ask me any doubt you have. This is amazing, okay? Moshe is trying to leave behind a world with no doubt, okay? Now, it's exactly that attempt that leads the process to the creation of doubt, okay? And Yehoshua gets hurt by the question, right? Yehoshua said to him, my rabbi, have I ever left you for one moment and gone elsewhere? Did you not, you, Moshe, wrote about me, Yehoshua. Did you not write about me? And his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a youth, did not budge from the tent. Well, why are you asking me if I don't know, if I have any doubts? Of course I don't have any doubts. My knowledge and your knowledge are the same. I was always with you. Okay? You already sense the danger with somebody who thinks that they know everything, okay? Now, actually, I think Moshe and Yehoshua share a lack of understanding here. They both don't understand the danger that there is in replication of leadership. Okay, replication of leadership. Using tools of the past for the present is insufficient by definition. And Moshe and Yehoshua both, in different ways, make that mistake. Now, luckily, metaphysical dynamics kick in. Okay? Miyad tashash kocho shel Yehoshua. Right away, Yehoshua lost all his energies. And this is a deep loss of energy. Okay? It's a deep exhaustion. And the outcome of that deep exhaustion is v'nishtakchu mimeno 300 halachot. Right? All these doubts are suddenly born. He has all this forgetfulness suddenly take place. And the moving, surprising response, Amdu kol Yisrael ergo, and the children of Israel want to kill him. What do you mean? You're our leader. You can't forget. That's not something that can happen to you. Okay? And in that, they join Moshe and Yehoshua in the misunderstanding that if Yehoshua is like Moshe, they're not going to make it in the land of Israel, that they need a different leader in order to start their new move into the land of Israel. Okay? So everyone is very, very afraid of change and not understanding the necessity of it. I'll say one more thing since we're doing a close reading of a text. I think you have it in front of you. There is a dispute among the commentators who actually had this loss of energy. Okay, I read the version that says that it's Yehoshua. But there are those who say and who explain that it's actually Moshe who lost his energy. It's Moshe who got so hurt by Yehoshua's arrogance, and his pain caused Yehoshua to forget. Okay, and we know the dynamics in other stories. When somebody in the Beit Midrash gets hurt, the person who hurts him is in trouble. Okay, and that's what happens here. Moshe gets so hurt by Yehoshua's response, and then Yehoshua forgets. So, forgetting turns, right, the need for innovation into tangible. Okay? Forgetting is like a tangible manifestation that I now need new knowledge. But actually, it's new realities, new situations, new questions that brings to those needs. Those needs are going to happen in the future in any case. It's just that the forgetting holds it very strongly. And then God kind of says to Yeshua, look, I can't give you the answers, which is a similar answer to the ones that Shmuel and Yeshua give in the previous story, right? Lo b'shamayim hi, and so on. I can't give you the answer. He just suggests change the subject, and the issue of war we're going to leave aside for now. So that was story number two. Now let's go to version number three. In the Mishnah they taught, here the numbers are a little different. The 1,700 laws and learnings were forgotten in the times of the mourning of Moshe. Said Rabbi Abahu, but Otniel, the son of Knaz, brought them back out of his learning. Now I want to go back to the first story and to the comment that you made, and maybe push you to explain or ask somebody else. What is the connection between the period of mourning and the forgetfulness? Why does it happen at this point? How do you understand the dynamics there? Is there a connection or is it coincidental? We see that the forgetting is kind of a punishment or a response to somebody getting hurt in the dynamics between Moshe and Yeshua. But what happens here, or in the first story, that brings to the forgetfulness?
Because in general, I think that mourning is just being sort of like a wash of time, where there's no boundaries and there's no beginning and there's no end. And just sort of a lot of gray without precision. And I feel like when I think about Beit Midrash learning, I think of clarity and precision, and like both people needing to be fully present and like in your sharpness, which just feels to me like the opposite of mourning. I'll just say, like of my own mourning, I was convinced for years that I didn't sit Sheva for my father. It was because I had forgotten the entire period, and that feels connected here.
Interesting. Thank you, Stephen.
I think also within the process of any sort of difficult emotional space, there's an instinct to push away those things and to consciously forget those things which remind us of the loss that we've experienced. And it's a protective measure that we actually sometimes very unconsciously take to forget those things that might remind us of the absence of somebody or something that we loved. And I think in this case, for the people of Israel, the laws and learnings were obviously so bound up with the leadership of Moshe that it could have been a very conscious letting go of things that really caused them pain, reminding of his absence.
Great, thank you. Yeah.
Does learning cease during a period of mourning? So is it the lack of learning that causes
interesting. Pain? Great. Great. For sure, we focus on learning on specific things during that period, and yeah, that's interesting. Maybe it was just practical, you're saying, not even, right, psychological or emotional. Yes.
They're just so preoccupied with thinking about Moshe the man that they're not thinking about the work that's attached to him.
Right. I admit that that's where I went, and it's interesting to hear the opposite kind of versions, okay? I wonder if they're so focused on the person and the personality, right, that they forget the legacy. Okay, that's part of what happens in times of mourning, and they forget the knowledge. So Yeshua, I think, in these stories, he demonstrates, right, a kind of inability to accept that this is an end, right? And because of this lack of acceptance, he actually creates the rupture, right? Creates the end. And Otniel ben Knaz in this story is a complete opposite, right? I don't know, so I sit and learn. People, here's where it's created, okay? He kind of manifests that the new and old, right, they kind of bridge each other, right? There's a new way of learning, and that's going to create the bridge to the old knowledge, okay? Very, very simply for Otniel ben Knaz. So now again, I want to go back to my three questions and see how these stories play out the questions, right? I'll remind you what they were. First of all, how the tension between rupture and continuity play out in these stories. Second of all, is there a place and what's its significance? And third of all, is there a narrative that we can play out here that is other than there was a death and now we exist in a reality of lack? Okay. So first of all, about the tension between rupture and continuity. Shmuel, Yoshua, Otniel ben Knaz, they all accept that there's an end of an era here, right? The need to learn now in a different way. They all accept that fact. And in that sense, they're all accepting a new beginning. And it's only when there's such a recognition that they can turn to other alternatives, right? Lo b'shamayim hi, or pilpul, kind of alternatives that enable the continuity of learning. Place. Is there a place that is significant here? I always think of this story obviously takes place in the desert, okay? In the desert, there's something of a non-place to the desert, okay? The desert has many, many qualities of a non-place, right? It's not a home, it's not a land, you move in it, you're not stable and present, okay? So there's something almost anti to a place that the desert holds in it, and we'll go back to that in a minute. And now the question of the alternative narrative, right? The second story, I think, most strongly holds the negative narrative. In other words, the narrative of before things were good, something bad happened, and now reality is bad. Okay? The second story holds that. It's like being banished from Eden, right? Eden was this ideal. We sinned. We were banished. Okay? It's that kind of narrative. But I think the existence of the other two stories that sandwich this one actually in the Talmudic discussion present us with a more neutral kind of story and pushes us to try and understand the stories a little bit differently. First of all, let's try and tell the story differently. At the beginning, there was a state of order. The state of order was that for 40 years, the children of Israel wandered around the desert. The desert actually was their home. They were very well taken care of there, right? They were a slave tribe, slowly, slowly turning into a people. God fed them and gave them water. When he felt it was right, he also gave them the law. And they existed there for generations, right? 40 years is a few generations. And then there was a tunnel of disorder that suddenly happened, okay? Whether the disorder in our case is the death of Moshe, and suddenly the place didn't seem right anymore. Okay? And then there was need to come out of this chaos somehow with a creating of a new sense of order, right? A Torah that is no longer in heaven, or the technique of pilpul, and so on. The place of Torah changes. It's now placed in a new place. Is the Torah now in exile? Or is the Torah now actually home? Right? A rejection. The stories reject this black and white option of seeing things. It's not either home or exile. It's a new place in a new reality with a new order. And that's the new place of Torah, not in heaven anymore. And I think that there's a connection between a narrative of new order, right? A narrative that tries to reject seeing the past as ideal and the present as lacking, and the lack of place that many of our beginning stories hold in them. And that's the thought that I'm going to want to end with. Many of our tradition's beginning stories have this process of move from one place to the other and challenge us with, should we read them as a narrative of ideal, break, lack, or should we try and see them as two different types of order on the sides of some momentary chaos where the two different sides try to resolve that middle chaos. And it's based on on how we understand place. Because what initially, at a first glance, might be considered as exile, very often, if we examine it, as we saw, needs to be rethought of. Okay, so we talked of the desert. The desert is also, in a very deep way, Moshe's home, right? Moshe, who does all kinds of things in Egypt that make him have to run away from Egypt, runs to the desert, and the desert is where he meets his wife and has children and gets a job, whether we consider that from Yitro, his father-in-law, or from God, and where he's going to spend. It's for him a safe haven in very many ways. Avraham, I think, is a similar model. Abraham is told, Lech lecha, go from your home. Okay, but there's no doubt that where he's going to, in a real way, is going to again become his home. Now, interestingly, when he gets to Israel, he doesn't run to Jerusalem. So there's a rejection here, a cultural rejection of turning the place that he's going to a central place. But there's an acceptance that there isn't a black and white reality vis-a-vis where he came from and where he's going to now. And we saw it also with the Garden of Eden. You know, is the Garden of Eden the product of sin, and then we had to leave it and go into the world? Or actually, can you imagine existing with no responsibility and without understanding the difference between right and wrong? I think our existence in the world today, it may not be perfect, but it probably is home in a very deep way, even though it's the product of being banished from Eden. So all these stories put into question both the notion and the centrality of a specific place, of a sacred place, of a sacred center, both because they blur and sometimes because they completely ignore the place at the moment of beginning. So there's a move towards the margins, or towards places that are marginal, right? And spaces that are significant spaces at beginnings often are marginal places. And I think this is related to the attempt to shift our narrative from a narrative of it was good, now it's bad, to a more complex one, where we think of things as old order versus new order, and kind of the product of chaos and the attempt to its resolution. So let's go back for 1 minute as a summary to our three questions. Okay, the first question was rupture and continuity. The second was the significance of place. And the third was, can we create a narrative that goes beyond the narrative of destruction, which is preceded by a lacking reality? So telling beginning stories that point to other beginnings, right, while accepting a specific end, I think is one technical technique of dealing with the tension between rupture and continuity. Right? In Yavne, we point backwards to Hillel. In Yehoshua, we point backwards to Sinai. I started my story by telling about my grandmother, and so on. These narratives of beginning push us very strongly to think of the process not as a process that is a move from good to bad, but as a process of old order, chaos, and back to a different kind of order. It's such an optimistic way to look at the need to innovate, right? It's not an old person, an old regime being hurt by innovation, but an understanding that destruction of the temple is an opportunity to restructure all of our tradition's knowledge, right? So that it doesn't get forgotten. It's an opportunity to look at Moshe's death as an opportunity to take new responsibility vis-a-vis our Torah. And I admit that when I try to give that narrative to myself, when I think of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, and try to see that as an opportunity, I have a harder time, and maybe it's something that only happens with hindsight and with much more time and perspective. And the last point is the point of space. There's no sacred place in these stories. These beginning stories are opportunities to centralize marginal places, or to question their centralities, right? Is Bobov the center? Is New York the center? Or possibly is the Beit Midrash in Hadar the center, where in the last summers I teach my students my grandmother's Bobov tunes. Thank you all for coming. I want to suggest that everyone go get a drink because it's very hot before you head upstairs for the next part, and just to invite you to our next day of learning, which is the 10th of July. We have a Yom Iyun, and everyone is welcome.
Thank you. That was very nice.
Thank you very much. What's your name?
Jonathan. Jonathan Grossberg, and this is my fiancée, Nina Gold.
Thank you.
Thank you
for coming.
Thank you.
Where do you know where the water is?
They probably drink upstairs where
okay,
they were
great.
Before.
Hi.
Thanks.
Hi. I just heard on my pod over a talk you gave on Amy Ella, which was talking about women
right.
in the Talmud. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a book in there. Is there a book that's in print?
Yeah, it's in Hebrew. Oh. It might even be on sale up here.
What's it called?
It's called Nashim Bichnim, Nashim Bachutz. Women in, women out.
Got it, right. And is it taking all the Talmudic stories and analyzing the role of women in them?
It takes all the legal texts that use the phrase Endi Ela, I have not but,
right.
and examines, it asks the question of how women are included and excluded in those texts.
Does it relate the Midrash Halakha to Midrash Agada?
It's mainly Halakha. It's Midrash Halakha. Some of them happen to be on Agadic sources, like there's a question about Ma'amad al-Sinai, okay, were women present there?
Is there a text you could recommend on reading Midrash Haggadah that deal with women and how to analyze them and parse them in a way that's
helpful. A lot of feminists wrote it. Is there a specific one, a specific Midrash you're thinking about,
no.
or you want to look in general?
No, I'm trying to learn just how to approach them. I find the stories fascinating.
Turn this off.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. No. I want to turn it off and then I want to continue talking to you. I don't know. I'll give you a few suggestions. Tell me a word about you and why you're interested, and then I can think what to recommend.
I'm
your name.
Eileen. Okay. I have a master's in Jewish ed. And I was actually in the study group with some friends that were started. We were just looking at the Agadot and reading the ones that dealt with women.
Which Agadot, remember?
Oh God, which ones? It was a few, several months ago. Like one where, I'm terrible with the names, she was a prostitute and her brother-in-law goes to redeem her.
Thank you, Seth.